90.7 FM and streaming online at KBOO.FM.
KBOO is in the middle of our annual spring membership drive. It's that time of year where KBOO is all abuzz, and we need you to come jive with our radio hive. Help us reach our $56,000 goal and keep the hive alive. Just go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And thanks.
I'm Trevor Collins. This is Times Like Now. Please look up past episodes wherever you get your podcasts, Google Casts, Pandora, Spotify, and more. Today I'm speaking with Jewel James, the master carver from House of Tears Carvers from the Lummi Indian Reservation in Washington State. They have created a totem pole that will travel across the United States this summer, visiting Native sacred sites along the way, and eventually come to rest at the Smithsonian Institute. They're calling this the Red Road to DC on this episode of Times Like Now. Hello. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm glad to have you here. It's an honor.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So tell me a little bit more about Red Road to DC, the totem pole journey to protect sacred sites. When was this dream created? Who had this dream, first of all, to do this? Or has this been done before?
Well, I think you have to know a little bit about who we are first. We're the House of Tears Carvers here on the Lummi Indian Reservation in the state of Washington. And for the past 20 years, we have been doing totem pole journeys to different communities up in Canada and all across the United States. We've been carving totem poles and using them to draw attention to concerns of various communities that are experiencing attacks upon the local environments. Some of these projects that have international impacts in both Canada and the United States. We've sent totem poles up to northern Alberta for the tribes up there that were fighting against the tar sands. We gave poles to the Tsleil-Waututh Nation up in Vancouver that was battling the Kinder Morgan pipeline that was coming through their territory. We brought a totem pole to Winnipeg, counter the pipeline east that was going to be sending tar sands crude to eastern plants. Then, of course, the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock stood up and opposed. We went down to Standing Rock with the pole when we were heading up to Winnipeg. But the Northern Cheyenne were battling or considering opposing a major super strip mine for coal that was right on the border of their reserve that was not only traditional territory, but had numerous sacred sites in it. And the traditional people were concerned because the modern tribal leadership were not coming out against it. So we carved a totem pole, and that helped unite the tribal leaders, both traditionalists and modern tribal leaders. And eventually they defeated the application for that coal strip mine. We've been battling to try to free a whale that's been in captivity in Florida for the past 52 years. It was taken from our historical territory. We are the Clock Commission. We're from the San Juan Islands of Washington State, Puget Sound, or the Salish Sea. That was our Aboriginal territory. Sometimes we're called Cedar people, and sometimes Canoe people, and sometimes Salmon people. Those are all important to us, but the more importantly, whale reflected the health of the Salish Sea itself. The southern resident killer whale pods at risk because of lack of Chinook, which is one of its primary food sources.
Can you tell me a little bit about what this project is going to be doing with this particular totem pole? Where is it going,
I was just saying that all of these are tied. What it did is it created attention, and people in the East gave us a call back in November. They were totally aware of the a dozen or more totem pole journeys that we have successfully conducted in order to create public awareness. And so we were asked if we would consider carving a totem pole and bringing it to Washington, D.C., but before we get to D.C., to bring it to sacred sites and sacred waters and to draw attention to the concerns tribes and local people have about protecting these areas. We agreed, and we found a log that one of the local traditional carvers here on the Lummi Reservation had in his yard. He was carving one half of it, and so we bought the second half of the log and moved it to our carving shop, and we began carving February 7th this year. The log is 24 feet 8 inches tall. It's 43 inches wide. At the top, the moon on top is 52 inches wide. It is 2 feet thick, except for where we added the head of the diving eagle and the dorsal fins of the sea wolf and the sea bear. The goal is to create a public outcry or a public voicing of the need to protect sacred sites and sacred waters. So the a group that formed, Judith Lobank and Becca Econonopoulos and Dr. Kurt Russo and others that have worked with them on a committee basis have been coordinating the identification of the sacred sites and places that we will stop and work with host tribes to conduct ceremonies and prayers for the protection of these places. They've identified like the call to remove the four dams on the Snake River because of its destruction of the Chinook populations. And we've carved a couple of Chinook on the totem pole to represent that, but also such as the Snake River, it's the Columbia River, it's the Fraser River, it's the Nooksack River, it's the Alwa River. All the rivers pretty much in the Pacific Northwest have spring and fall Chinook populations at risk. And the other salmon populations are at risk. And so on the eagle that we carved, we put what we call the salmon head designs on the shoulder for all salmon species up and down the Pacific coast that native populations and modern fishing communities are dependent upon. They asked us to go to Bear Butte and Bear's Ears, Chaco Canyon, the Black Hills, the Missouri River, and stop at Standing Rock again. And we're gonna go up to White Earth and Bay Mills. Working with the local tribal group, we will identify the sacred sites they're concerned about and conduct ceremony using the pole as the initial draw to pull us together.
Sure. How many states will you be visiting in total?
Well, I didn't count the states at this time as we zigzag across because I just never got that far yet. I will count them. I mean, I know we're going to Washington and Oregon and California, New Mexico, Oklahoma, maybe Kansas, cutting through Montana, Utah, South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, you know, and so those are places where we're going to be stopping, but there's more states that we're actually driving through. You know, we're going to be doing 3, 4, 5, and sometimes 700 miles distance in order to get to the next stop. And we hope that we're going to be well organized and be able to meet the deadlines that have been set for us.
So the pole is weighing, what, 4,900 pounds, I think I read on your press kit, 4,900 pounds. How are you carrying this large pole?
Well, first of all, I've dealt with a lot of cedar, and I've actually carved some fir before. And when I originally got the log, I estimated it was about 2 to 3 ton. And it turns out, when we finally got it loaded on the truck, we have a flatbed with a 20-foot bed on it and with a an additional 3 foot if we raise the metal lift that's attached to the back. And so when we do that, then we only have about a foot and a half overhang. The pole is, like I said, 24 feet, 8 inches long. And I bought the truck, and I was hoping, I paid $5,300 with my own money in order to try to get a truck that we can haul this totem, at least to the local communities in Washington State. But we're having a lot of, it turns out the company that sold it to me wasn't that honest. And, they told me it ran great, but it'll only do 47 miles an hour down the freeway. You know, we're bound to get tickets if we use it on a interstate freeway. And so we're worried about that. We will have it looked at, but we finally convinced somebody to come forward and to help us at least get a truck to tow a trailer. We're going to be putting it on a 24-foot trailer and tow it behind a 350, which is heavy enough to handle it. So that's kind of the fix that we've resolved to use. And we appreciate the National Committee was able to help us do that. The thing is that before we leave Washington State, before we go on the Red Road to Washington, D.C., we're going to try to generate support here in Washington State. We're going to go to the Swinomish Tribe Reserve, the Tulalip Reservation, the Alwa Reservation, the Port Gamble Reservation, the Jamestown Reservation, the Nea Bay Reservation, the Quileute Reservation, the McCaw Reservation, the Yakima Reservation, the Nooksack Reservation, and the Squally Reserve, the Muckleshoot Reserve, and the Puyallup Reserve. And we're bringing it to Bellingham and Ferndale and Seattle and Blaine. We're bringing it to four islands in the San Juan Island Network. And so we're doing about 20 stops within Washington State. And one of the reasons is that this coming fall, we're going to be back in a battle with the U.S. Forest Service to demand that they protect and respect sacred sites that we have identified in the past 40 years that's located in the National Forest. They're going to be redoing their forest plan, and we're going to have to battle them once again to make sure that they consider the concerns of the Indian tribes. And so we have our own battles here in Washington State on sacred sites and places, and we want to use the initial movement through within Washington State to help unify us for the upcoming conflict. Now, we're going to go down to Oregon. We're going to be going into Celilo Falls and Portland, the city of Portland, and down to the boarding school, Chumawa, one of the oldest Indian boarding schools still operating in the United States. And we'll go over to the Sletch tribe on the coast and down to, I believe, the Chinook people. And then we're going to head down into California with the Klamath and the Hoopa and the Yurok. And there's a few tribes in between Northern California and Southern California that will be making some stops at some of their sacred sites. I know that we're being asked to go to the place that called Go Road, or where they had Doctor's Rock. That was a focus of a 1988 test case that went all over the Supreme Court. What happened is that the Forest Service was going to issue some logging permits to a company either that would come into the west end of the valley, or it could come into another company could come in on the east end of the valley. The one that came in from the west would destroy Doctor's Rock. The one that came in from the east would avoid destroying Doctor's Rock. And the Supreme Court normally would take the path of least resistance and least damages. And so we were hoping that they would have ruled that the company that was coming from the east is just as responsible and opportunistic as the one coming in from the west, and let them come in from the east because it won't destroy a Native American sacred site. No problem. But instead, the Supreme Court used it as an opportunity to undermine the American Indian Religious Freedom Act that was passed in 1978. And so we had to do 20 years of lobbying to try to undo some of the damage and secure various amendments in the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. For example, our tribe in the 1980s was raided for having eagle feathers on regalia. Our tribe was raided for having a spirit society that was not Christian in the 1980s also. You know, when federal prisons, prisoners were denied rights to ritual. In the case Oregon versus Smith, the Peyote Church lost a sacrament of peyote. And so we had to go to Congress to reinstate the feathers, to reinstate prisoners' rights, and to resecure the peyote sacrament for the Native American Church. And so that was done in the 1990s. And most of the elders that were involved in those type of campaigns are gone now, except for our good friend and national example, Suzanne Schoenharjo. She's still active, and she's very much engaged in a movement to protect Native American sacred sites. And we send our prayers to her and our good feelings and sing songs for her because she's a defender of Indian country in this area. We're going to be going down to Los Angeles. There's going to be an event, I guess, in Los Angeles. And then we're going to go into San Diego area, and we'll be working with Verona, Siquan and Viejas tribes, and conduct ceremonies with one or all three of them. One of the past chairmen is Viejas is working to coordinate all three tribes at this time. We've been asked to bring it over into Oklahoma, even though a lot of the tribes in Oklahoma are kind of in dispute right now. We're hoping that we'll be able to conduct ceremonies with them, at least one to three of those tribes. I know there's been a request for us to keep on going east and hit Kansas City and then turn around and head up to Colorado, where we'll have a gathering there. Now, this journey is pretty much our Pacific Coast leg of the Red Road to Washington, D.C. We'll be getting done with that in the early July. Then we're home for 2 weeks, and then we'll head east on the Red Road to Washington, D.C., and go to those other sites, like I said, to Snake River, Bear Butte, Bear's Ears, Chaco Canyon, Black Hills, those locations. And when we get to Washington, D.C., my understanding is that we'll have some ceremony, and we'll do some lobbying of Congress. Congress will be in session in July and August, and we hope to let the congressmen know that we're trying to generate grassroots support for the protection of Native American sacred sites and waters. And the poll would be turned over, my understanding, to the Smithsonian for storage. I believe they're going to have the Secretary of Interior receive it on behalf of the Biden administration. And between now and next year, this time, they'll be working on what to do with the poll. So far, it's been suggested that some of the photos and videos and images tied to prior totem pole journeys shall be used to surround the totem pole as a major display, and the totem pole and those additional displays may end up in a circular display going from museum to museum. Now, we've done that with a pole that we brought back east to Philadelphia 3 years ago, and it's been circulating through different museums. It was down in the University of Florida Museum in Gainesville, you know, and it's been in other museums up on the East Coast circulating around. And when we bring this totem pole back to the Smithsonian, we'll then pick up the pole that's been on tour for 3 years, and we'll bring it home.
I see. Can you tell me a little bit more about the history of the House of Tears carvers?
Well, first of all, my younger brother was the actual master carver. How that came about, when he was a young middle school youth, the Bellingham Whatcom County Museum had received a Ford grant to hire two Lummi master carvers to train four Lummi youth to become totem pole carvers. And out of the four youth, my late brother was the only one that could that picked it up. And so back in 1972, I started researching designs and mythology and other aspects of Pacific Northwest Indian art, including taking a couple courses with the late master carver Marvin Oliver at the University of Washington while I was a student there, in order to provide me a rich knowledge that I could share with my brother and assist him in his development of totem poles. So from 1972 to 1996, I worked with my late brother, Dale James. There was also another carver by the name of Chattiskatum Wichtilam. He died from heart complications and some diabetes. And then another artist by the name of Vern Johnson Jr., who was a Vietnam veteran and served two terms, one in Vietnam and one in Korea. But while he was in Vietnam, he was exposed to Agent Orange and he ended up getting cancer and died as well. My younger brother passed on from pneumonia back in 96. So of the four of us, I'm the only one that was a part of the original House of Tears carvers. And I've kept the House of Tears carvers alive in their memory. and so in 1996, my brother had committed to a contract to carve a totem pole that was going to go up in New York. It was a 28-footer. And so he died before he could finish carving it. So I finished carving the totem pole for him. And we sent it on up to the owners up in New York. And we've been kind of filling his shoes ever since. The House of Tears carver is pretty much composed of any nephews, nieces, cousins, relatives, or other people that want to get involved in some of our totem pole projects. The House of Tears carvers was incorporated under Lummi tribal law, but also federal law. The Tribal Governmental Tax Status Act authorizes Indian tribes to incorporate traditional organizations under their authority, and they still receive the tax break that you would if you're a 501c3 under federal law. So the House of Tears carvers has been around since the mid-1980s, and we've produced a lot of art, about 90% of the totem poles, and we've carved over 100 pieces, anywhere from 3 feet to 28 feet. About 90% to 95% have been donated to various causes. We put a lot of art in the Lummi community, and we put totem poles at old soldiers' homes. We put them at public schools for children. We put them at cancer centers, you know, and we put them in city parks and where children were hurt, like there was a pipeline explosion in Bellingham, and we put up totem poles at the pipeline site there for the children that were lost. And, you know, over the years, we've donated to Indian tribes, Indian organizations, and non-Indian communities and public schools and other institutions. We try to do public good. We try to create public awareness that the Native American communities are still rich with song, dance, traditional knowledge, traditional wisdom, symbols, and arts, crafts, and ceremonial aspects of our life. I know we fought really hard to to get ceremonial activity included in the Act of 2014 that was enacted by the United States Congress, the Tribal General Welfare Exclusions Act. We included ceremonial activity, and I personally was challenged by the IRS for several years. I fought with them, and in the end, I won that battle against the IRS, arguing that Native American arts and crafts are a part of our ceremonial knowledge and activity, and therefore exempted under the language of the ceremonial activity law that was included in the 2014 Act. That was just that, I just won that in 2018, and then the pandemic came out. And so we haven't been able to get it nationally exposed yet. But for us, we have a reason to want to be involved in the campaign too. First of all, we want more people to know that ceremonial activity that is exempted from federal taxation also includes arts and crafts done by enrolled tribal members and their children. Also, we want to make sure that any new laws dealing with the national forests and national parks includes the obligation of the United States to consult with the Indian tribes with in full faith and credit. And so we also hope to get implementation of the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples that we got President Obama to accept. The United States was one of the last to accept it. And it has about 18 provisions in it that deals with traditional art, traditional knowledge, and traditional culture and spirituality.
I read within your press release that one of your elders from the past, Tom Sampson, had said the totem pole is not what is sacred. It is the gathering of the people around the totem pole that is sacred. That seems like a great point and words of wisdom. I really am proud to be speaking with you and learning about this directly from you. Is there a website that people might be able to look at and learn from and see your journey as it progresses?
Well, yeah, it's Red Road to Washington, D.C. Red Road T.O. Washington, D.C.
.com.
And of course, you can Google Jewel James Carver, Totem Pole Journeys, and you're going to find a lot of stuff coming up, you know, and all of them kind of lead back, and you'll start seeing the Red Road to Washington, D.C. coming up more and more and more.
Jewel James, thank you very much. Saucy Elf, I really do appreciate your time, and thank you so much for what you're doing. And I'm going to be looking at the website and communicating with you, and I want to see how this goes out. I want to see photos of this. Thank you so much for joining me today.
All right. Thanks.
Past episodes of Times Like Now can be found wherever you get your podcasts, Google Casts, Pandora, Spotify. Please do like and subscribe. You can find me on Facebook as well, Times Like Now. Thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, for original music. I'm Trevor Collins, and I can be emailed trevor@timeslikenow.com. Thanks for listening. Look forward to speaking with you next time. Thank you.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is artist Amanda Wojcik. Her show, Small Shields and Other Shapes, is on now at the Elizabeth Leach Gallery in the Pearl through June the 2nd. And Amanda is also the head of the art department at the University of Oregon and is Zooming from Eugene. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Amanda.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Your show, Small Shields and Other Shapes, you know, people are going to go in and go, where are the shields? But they're mostly metal, steel pieces with holes cut in them, layered, painted.